Welcome to Politics is Local, a special election time series by the KHOI Community Radio production team. This week's program features the first of four candidate forums put on by the League of Women Voters of Ames and Storey County. KHOI is very pleased to be partnering with the League for this broadcast series. Today's forum, held last Thursday, September 29th, brought together the three candidates for the Iowa House District 45, Libertarian Eric Cooper, Republican Sandra Child Smith, and Democrat and incumbent Beth Wissell Crichel. For the first couple of questions, you'll notice that the voice of Libertarian candidate Eric Cooper is not heard. This is because he had to finish teaching a class and come over to the forum late. However, we do hear his opening words along with the other two at the beginning of the forum. Here's the forum moderator, Carol Alexander Phillips, describing the role of the League of Women Voters in our community.
From my hometown, maybe.
The League is nonpartisan and a political organization that encourages active participation in government through voter registration drives, scheduling of public policy through public lectures and forums such as this one, and by influencing public policy through education and advocacy efforts. We will begin with a 5-minute statement from the candidates. Beth.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. Thank you to the League of Women Voters for sponsoring this event. I am completing my 6th term and running for a 7th term for the state representative. In this past session, I served as the ranking member of the Human Resources Committee. I was also on Environmental Protection, Public Safety, and the Health and Human Services Appropriations. Little biographical background. I have been married to Tom Crochelle for 28 years. He is the program director for Cyclone TVs and has worked for the ISU Cyclones since 1985. I think that's 31 years, but I didn't do my math today. We have 2 adult children. Our daughter Liza is 23. She lives in San Francisco. She dances and teaches dance. And our son Robbie is 18, and he is a freshman at a different state university in Iowa. We always wonder what our children are going to do to embarrass us. Well, there you go. It has been a true honor to serve, and I look forward to another term. I've been proud to be a leader in the Iowa legislature on issues of civil rights, health care, women's rights, and voting rights. Today, we absolutely must look forward. We have an obligation to leave a healthy environment to our children and our grandchildren. We have ignored the threat of climate change for far too long. We see 100-year floods and extreme weather events all too often, including last week. We are losing topsoil at rates what we can't reproduce it. Iowa's rich agriculture economy is at risk. Clean water is a goal that we all share, but we are struggling with it. We have put millions of tax dollars into the problem, but we have seen virtually no results. These are issues that I intend to work on in the next session. Our schools are struggling. I had one teacher and one administrator tell me last year that they felt so undervalued by what we at the legislature are doing to encourage them to expand what they are teaching, to give them some positive feedback on what they do. There have been 6 years under Republican control of just meager state funding. It's time that we invest in Iowa's young people. Class size matters, and there is no doubt to that research. Higher education also has to become a priority again. Iowa Iowa State has grown at an enormous rate, 36,660 students. I think when I graduated with my master's, I mean, this is eons ago, I get it, 1987, there were 25,000 students. We have made exponential growth that we as a state need to keep up with. So we need to take this seriously and invest enough resources for a quality education, for quality housing, and for affordable tuition. We have a lot of other issues that we need to work on. Lily Ledbetter was just here yesterday talking about pay equity. We are 50th in the nation on our mental health services to those who are seeking services. And our Medicaid privatization is forcing providers to go under and leaving our vulnerable citizens not wondering where their services are going to come from. I want to thank you all again for coming, and I look forward to your questions and for a lively discussion this evening.
Now we'll hear from Sandra Child-Smith.
Thank you so much for coming. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Sandra Child-Smith, and I'm originally from Arlington, Texas. I ran track, and that's the way I got to Iowa State. My roommates and I were the first women who had full scholarships for track at Iowa State. So I tease my kids that they're Title IX babies, because without Title IX, they wouldn't be here. I met my husband, and you know the rest of the story. You end up staying in where your husband is from. My husband is a farmer, Dennis. We've been married for 32 years. I have two children. My son, I went to the Air Force Academy and is an F-16 fighter pilot. He is stationed in South Korea, and you know, he risks his life every day to protect our rights to do what we do. He has two children, and we are the grandparents that live in the phone, because that's the way we have to talk to them on FaceTime, which, thank goodness for that miracle. I have a daughter, Shelby, who went to St. Joe in Philadelphia, played ball, and continued on to play professionally in Ireland. She is an international banker in Ireland. She also is once again signed a contract to play more basketball. So she's playing ball over there again. She actually called me right before we started this meeting, because she just landed in Tahoe. She's doing the Spartan World Championship on Saturday. So if you get a chance to watch it on ESPN, I think she'll probably be a mid-packer, but you might catch her. I have a background in fashion. I was the national sales manager for a jewelry company. I traveled 12 states. I managed a whole bunch of sales reps. When I got tired of being on the road and decided I wanted to stay home with my kids, we opened a tumbling and trampoline gym, and I coached there. We had many people on the world championship team, and I loved to coach. Then again, my kids got really busy. My daughter started really playing heavy-duty basketball over, so we sold the gym. And after my kids both flew the coop, I started working for Sam Clovis, who ran for the Senate primary. And I found that I have a real passion for politics and campaigning, and I love to talk to people. And I was very fortunate that I got to basically travel the state with Sam. I started going to, I have to thank the League of Women Voters for kind of pushing me to run this way, because I started going to their Saturday legislative breakfasts, and I found that I have no voice, no voice whatsoever in this district. And I thought, you know, it's time. So I called people from around the state and the different connections that I have, and they all encouraged me to run. I believe that this is one of the races in Iowa where you will find two very distinctive choices. We are probably about as opposite as you can be. I believe in lower taxes and less government and more freedom. And I absolutely believe in being a citizen legislator. I do not believe that you need to be serving for years and years and years and years in Des Moines. I believe that you need to serve, go home, and live under what you did. And I think that's the way that the whole government was set up, you know, to have true citizen legislators, not professional politicians. You know, if you read the history of Iowa, because I, having grown up in Texas, really didn't know the history of Iowa. So I read about four different books, and they were absolutely fascinating. And the reason why they paid the legislatures a very small amount, and it was a very, it still is a pretty small amount, but which I'm not complaining, that's the way it should be. The reason they started paying such a small amount is because they did not want people to go down and just stay in Des Moines and make that their permanent job. They wanted them to go back and live and work and do the things in the communities. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I hope that you really think about the differences between the two of us. And I hope that you decide to vote for me November 8th.
Let's see. My name is Eric Cooper, and my day job is I'm associate professor of psychology at Iowa State. I'm a libertarian candidate for District 45, and I've run for office in Iowa for 9 times, 8 times as for the state legislature from Ames. And yeah, I do want to thank the League very much, because nobody's more grateful to receive the invitation to these forums than I am. When the invitations go out for things like this, the third-party candidates are the first ones left off the list. But every single election cycle, the League of Women Voters has always invited me to their forums, and I think everybody needs to know what good folks they are, because they really are. Well, let me explain the basic idea behind libertarianism. Libertarianism is essentially the philosophy of Thomas Jefferson, his idea of what the government should be. What Jefferson pointed out is the government is the institution in our society that's permitted to use force, physical violence. There are some activities that require force, and the reason why we need a government is to perform those activities. There are 4 activities that require force, and those are, first, protecting people from body crimes like rape and murder. Second, protecting people from property crimes like theft and fraud and vandalism and pollution. Third, adjudicating contract disputes when there's some sort of dispute about a contract. And then fourth, there are certain categories of economic goods known as public goods that, for one reason or another, the market doesn't supply in the appropriate levels. And a good example would be like lighthouses. Hard to make money operating a lighthouse, and so that's why we would need a government to provide that. But very little else requires force. And having the government do anything beyond the specific activities that require force is a bad idea. And the reason I'd say it's a bad idea is because the government's a monopoly. And like all monopolies, it has very little incentive to please its customers and very little incentive to be cost-effective. When we give more and more responsibility to the government, we're giving more and more responsibility to the least efficient institution in our society. So when I say that the government shouldn't be doing things like fire protection or the post office, for example, I'm not saying that those things shouldn't be done. What I'm saying is that there's probably a better way of doing them than through the government. So tonight, I want to answer the questions the way Thomas Jefferson might have answered them if he had been living in modern times. I'm going to apply his philosophy to the modern problems that we're facing. And I want you to note the distinction between what Jefferson intended our government to be and what it's become. Thank you very much.
At this point, it's time for audience participation.
Okay, thank you, and good evening. I'm Bev Krumpel. I'm from Ames, and my question has to do with mental health. You mentioned, I think Beth mentioned, that we're 50th in the nation. And there's approximately 66% of the women at Mitchellville in prison have mental health issues. And we are putting our people in prison rather than treating them. And I'd like to know what you propose for bettering our mental health here in Iowa so that we, number one, aren't 50th, but that we can meet the needs of those people.
Sandra?
I agree with you. I think it's really bad. This is one area, you did pick the one area Beth and I probably do agree on, and I think that there are a number of different things that we need to do. We need to get more beds. You know, obviously when the governor closed the hospitals, that shut down a lot of beds. People are having to go out of state and travel lots of distances, and that's really hard for families, and you know that families are important in mental health. I also know that there's a real shortage of psychiatrists and other people that are in the mental health field. I would like to see us encourage students to go into those fields, whether that means that we give them some kind of tuition assistance or something, you know, forgive some loans for to go into that field if they intern practice in Iowa. And I also think we need to look at some other states and see how they deal with their rural communities, because there's states like Texas and Wyoming. I mean, we're not the only rural state in the country, and they all have these issues, you know, whether they work on more telemed kind of things. I don't know. I don't know the right answer, but I do know that we need to get some better minds than I am to really brainstorm this kind of thing and really talk about what we can do for solutions.
Next, incumbent Beth Wessel-Crichel.
Thank you for the question. I think this is a critical issue that we absolutely have to deal with. I met with a constituent this year who had an absolute horror story regarding her son who went into a catatonic state at Mary Greeley. Because he was an adult, he was shipped off without their knowledge. He then, still in a catatonic state, couldn't get his records to him because he had to sign off on that. So they got him another psychiatrist. He's 77 miles away from his parents. His parents don't know where he is. And then this new psychiatrist has to diagnose him in a state where he's not diagnosable. You know? So he was misdiagnosed. This is a tragedy. And this particular woman says when she retires, she is absolutely leaving the state because mental illness runs in her family, and she wants to go someplace where she will be cared for in her retirement. This is just very, very sad. As my opponent mentioned, the governor did close two MHIs and a third of another. So the beds are going to become more and more limited. He did that single-handedly, but I have to admit that I didn't see any great resistance from Republican lawmakers in the House. The average age of a psychiatrist today in Iowa is 51, and the average age of almost any other doctor is about 36. So we are talking about a huge climb in terms of getting the services that we need. We have tried forgivable loans. The problem is that promoting them is not funded. So we have money in there to give somebody a forgivable loan, but we have no way of getting that information to the individuals. That takes time, and it, you know, where do you go to provide that and to encourage people to use that? We have a whole, it's one page that we get every year in the HHS budget on what we've done to try and increase the workforce in the mental health field, and essentially none of it is funded for promotions, and we have no data yet on how much of that money is being distributed, how much of it is being used. I'm working on that. I find that very frustrating when we have such a crisis and we don't even know how the programs that we have actually implemented work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Susan Meenan, and I'm from Ames. And I guess I have a question for Beth. And Sandra brought up a point that maybe our representation in Des Moines has been going on a little bit too long. And I guess, you know, how would you respond to that, that maybe you've been in a little too long? And I'd just like to hear your response to that.
Sure. I think one of our most beloved lawmakers locally is Johnny Hammond, who I think served for 22 years, maybe 23. I can't remember exactly, but she served for a long time actually in the House and the Senate, and she had started in the Board of Supervisors. Chuck Grassley was elected the year I was born. He was elected to the Iowa House the year I was born. Now, I'm an empty nester. I am not young. He served in the Iowa House for 16 years. I have no objections to voting Chuck Grassley out this year, but I don't think years of service is necessarily an indication of whether it's time to go. I think what voters need to look at is, do you agree with me on the issues that I work on? And by voting your legislator out, there are some things that you need to know. You get to elect me and hold me accountable on Saturday mornings or through email or however you want to. But if you elect a new person, that person is learning everything new, and the staff leads that person. The more turnover there is in a seat, the more power that the staff has, not the person that you elected. So you will have a very hard time keeping that person accountable. Leadership is important. People who have been serving for longer periods of time have significant leadership, which you see with Senator Grassley. He has tons of leadership examples. I, as I said, am serving as ranking member of the Health and Human Service, or the Human Service Resources Policy Committee. They're two similar names. And that's an important committee. It's very important to me, and it's very important to the people that I serve. So I think the consistency is very important. The learning curve is steep. And clearly we have had very reputable individuals serve for much longer than I have.
Obviously, I disagree. And as far as Grassley goes, yes, I loved Chuck Grassley, but I think it was time for him to retire too. And but obviously the Democrats didn't have much of a bench to put up against him, so I will support him wholeheartedly. I disagree that the staff's going to run the things, because Beth does not know me at all. She's not known me this whole entire race. That's not the way it works at my house or for me. And I would bet you could talk to any of the people that I've worked with at the House right now, and they would agree with that. Sam Clovis was spending the night at my house the other day, and he said, you know, Sandra, I hope you get elected, because I can't wait to see how those old guys have to deal with you. And they're not going to push me around, and I will do what I need to do that I feel that my constituents have said is best for them, because I will be representing District 45, the entire district, not just the Democrats, not just the Republicans, but the entire district.
My name is Joel Rod. I'm from Ames. Over many years now, many states have passed laws like voter ID, no voting on Sunday, shortening the number of days you can vote ahead of time, cutting the number of poll workers so there are long, long lines. Some of these laws in some states like Ohio have been stopped by the courts. This is all in the name of massive voter fraud, which has been discounted by the Brennan Center in Philadelphia. The Brennan Center follows voting and voting rights and what's happening, and keep the statistics on that. So my question to you is, I worked the polls in Ames for 18 years, never saw any evidence of voter fraud. And so could you both speak to the issue of voter fraud? And what do you think? Is it really happening in Iowa?
Republican candidate Sandra Child-Smith.
I don't agree that we should limit voting with any of the names, things that you named off, you know, less poll workers, you know, everything, that sort of thing, shortening the length. But I do agree with voter ID. And I do think that I've door knocked, and I've door knocked the entire district twice. Some of the people I've seen three times. I've had a couple of people that have told me that They actually saw fraud at their precinct. But the sad part is that they didn't feel comfortable reporting it. You know, there is one in particular that said there's a lady that came in and claimed she lived on their street. She said, I know everyone on that street. She did not live on that street. And then she was allowed to go ahead and vote. This was the last election cycle. I don't think it occurs a lot, but even one time is wrong. And we don't know. We don't know the amount that really occurs, because they're not going to step up and say, hey, really, I'm a fraud. And most people are not going to step up and say something about it either. There'll be a few, but a lot of people won't say anything about it. But no, we shouldn't hinder people's right to vote or ability to vote or anything. And I think Paul Pate is going out of his way to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to vote, whether you're disabled, you know, if you have someone has to go out to the car and vote for you, you know, help you. There are so many things they're trying to work out. But no, I don't agree with everything except for voter ID.
Thank you. That's a great question. I am proud to have been the floor manager of the same-day voter registration legislation that passed. Well, I don't really remember what year, but it's been a few years. I don't recommend that anybody wait until election day, because it does slow up the lines and it is more complicated to register to vote. But I am proud that ISU students who move twice a year, at least, have the opportunity to go to the polls and vote on election day. It does have its problems. I mean, it just takes more time. So I know League of Women Voters, I know Paul Pate, I know lots of people. I believe the auditor's office has been out there registering voters. I've been out there registering voters. But there's 36,660 of them, so it's a challenge. I do want to say on voter ID, I have objected and voted against voter ID numerous times. It didn't come up, I believe, in the last 2 years, but the former Secretary of State spent $380,000, as I recall. I'm not great with numbers, but that's the one that kind of stuck with me, trying to prove fraud. And he came up empty-handed, absolutely empty-handed. We have problems getting people to the polls. We don't have problems with overvoting. And we just need to make sure that we make it as easy as possible to vote. When a registration in, I'm sure the auditor is going to tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe she checks 6 or 5 different lists to make sure that that person actually lives where they live, their social security number, you know, that they're not a felon. I mean, there are securities. We have securities. And I appreciate the securities that are already in place, and I support making sure that we have a good access to your right to vote. This is not a privilege. This is a right. It's a constitutional right, and we have to make sure that Iowans have that right.
You're listening to a forum held last week by the League of Women Voters among the three candidates for Iowa House District 45, Libertarian Eric Cooper, Republican Sondra Childs-Smith, and Democrat and incumbent Beth Wissell Crichel. The first respondent to the next question is Sondra Childs-Smith. This is Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio.
In 2010, the Iowa voters passed a constitutional amendment for the Iowa Waters and Land Legacy Trust Fund, otherwise known as IWIL. That would fund the Resource and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund, would provide funding for water quality as well as other uses. The trust fund has no money in it, however, because the way it was going to be funded was of the next sales tax increase, the first 0.3 cents would go to IWIL. It's been 6 years now, and there hasn't been a sales tax increase. I understand the Iowa State Association of Counties, ISACS, supervisors affiliate, is proposing that the legislature pass a 1 cent sales tax. That would then, next session, which would then mean 0.3 cents would go to IWIL. I've also been told that the remaining 5/8% then would go to mental health funding. But I have the concern that I don't understand whether it actually would replace property taxes, if that's the intent, or whether it would actually be more money for mental health funding, which we need desperately, particularly because by 2019, we're going to run out of any surplus funds and have some real problems with our mental health funding. So question is, would you support the 1 cent sales tax increase to fund IWIL and mental health funding, and would you support it if it would increase mental health funding or just simply replace property taxes?
I absolutely don't support any tax increase, and I have no problem with money going to either one of those, but we have to find it somewhere else in the budget. If it takes take one of the other 1 penny, 1 cent that we have and divide it up and do it that way, we can't keep on putting more and more tax burden on the hardworking Iowans. You know, it's right now we are number 43 in tax affordability in the United States. That's not a good thing. You know, my opponent has voted in the last 6 years to raise your taxes $2.41 billion with a B. We can't do that. It's not fair to the hardworking Iowans. No, I wouldn't support any kind of tax increase.
Thank you, Linda. I have to admit that in 2010, when this was on the ballot, and even voting to get it on the ballot, I was opposed to this form of funding any state program. First of all, a sales tax is regressive, and it hurts lower-income people more than it hurts higher-income people, and I'm opposed to that. I also didn't believe that the legislature would do it, and 6 years later, I am proven correct. We have not done it. And so to have this idea that this 1 or 3/8 cents is going to be there by passing a constitutional amendment if the legislature has to act, you know, I didn't have the confidence, and I still don't have the confidence that it will do it. I proposed this year that we do it like we did the infrastructure tax for schools, that we go county by county, and you allow each county to raise their taxes, and then after 99 counties do it, we pool the money, which is how we need the money pooled, to distribute it to the areas in the state where it's most needed. That bill came out very late. I intend to propose it again because locally people are very responsible. They see what's going on in their area, and they want a cleaner environment. I believe we can't leave a crumbling environment for our children. And so I have decided that I will support this, but I do want to increase the earned income tax credit for low-income individuals who will be negatively impacted by it. Mental health funding is also a high priority of mine, you know, and I would not substitute it one for the other.
My name is Ann Brenneman. I'm from Ames, and my question is, would you vote to fund or defund Planned Parenthood, and what would be your justification?
I've been a strong advocate for Planned Parenthood and the services that they provide. 97% of the services that are provided by Planned Parenthood are around health, specific health issues like cancer screenings, birth control. And honestly, there is no other place for many, many women to go without Planned Parenthood. I have talked to all the other clinics and representatives from them, and they agree. There is no state funding to Planned Parenthood for abortions, not a penny. According to the Iowa poll, 74% of Iowans support Planned Parenthood for be funded by the state for family planning. And it's an indication to me of how many people have used Planned Parenthood, how much they value it, and how important it is to this state. In this particular district, 50% of My constituents are 34 years old or younger, clearly in their reproductive age, and I have a feeling that it would be much higher than 74%. I think it's the right thing to do. I've always fought for it, and I will continue to fight for it.
Thanks for that question. I absolutely support defunding Planned Parenthood. I disagree a lot with what Beth said for statistics. It's proven that over 30% of Planned Parenthood's business is in the abortion business. I don't believe that we need to be funding the killing of babies. I also know that there are a lot of other places that women can go for their health care. Obamacare was a big thing, you know, a big thing. And that insurance covers a lot of the cancer screenings, the mammograms, et cetera. Planned Parenthood does not do mammograms. I dare you to call them and ask them to do a mammogram. I think that they can do, there's enough private funding out there for people that believe in that, that they can be funded. I don't believe that Iowa tax dollars need to go to something that people really don't believe in morally.
I would say I think Planned Parenthood's a great organization, but I don't think they should be getting tax dollars because I don't think that's a legitimate use of tax dollars. What I would say is the only thing we should be spending tax dollars on are the legitimate functions the government has that actually require force. And providing the services that Planned Parenthood provides does not require force. I think it's great if people want to contribute to private charity. I think private charity is the best way of providing for the poor because it's responsive, more responsive than government funding is going to be. So, although I think Planned Parenthood's a great organization, no, they shouldn't get a dime of government money. All right, now I'll do my opening statement, if that's all right.
Hi, my name is Christina Kinsella. Thank you all so much for being here. This is incredibly important to voters. My question is concerning pregnant workers' rights. So right now women make up about half of the workforce, and their working is important not only to the economic security of their families, but also the economic security of our communities. However, because we don't have paid family leave, a lot of women, when they become pregnant or are breastfeeding, are forced out of the workforce. So my question is, there was a bill that made it through the Senate last session. It died in the House, that would have required businesses to provide reasonable accommodations to pregnant women and breastfeeding women. Reasonable accommodations include things like the ability to carry a water bottle with you on the floor, increased bathroom breaks, access to a stool to sit, a sanitary and appropriate place to express breast milk. Would you support legislation like this in the future?
I would not support that because I believe that all interactions among human beings should be voluntary. That is, both the employer and the employee have to agree to the terms of employment. And now you have the government coming in and dictating that now we're going to be on the side of the employee and dictate to you, business owner, what you have to do. If the cost to the business owner of having the pregnant employee outweigh the benefits of having them, then yes, that employee should be fired if the business doesn't want them anymore. Any sort of employment decision has to be an agreement between both the employer and the employee. Employee decides to become pregnant, they got to make that trade-off. There are costs associated with pregnancy, one of which might be losing your job. And, I can imagine somebody not wanting to lose their job, in which case they shouldn't become pregnant. If they want to become pregnant, then they have to, might lose their job. But in a free society, you shouldn't be forcing people, and this is a clear example of tyranny of the majority. A lot of us are workers, but few are business owners. And so we're saying, well, it's okay to restrict the business owner's freedom of association because I'm not a business owner. Well, I think that's a terrible thing to do. All interactions between people should be voluntary. The government should not be imposing restrictions on one side of a voluntary interaction.
Okay, so I have supported some of these kinds of, not all of them have made it to the House, as you mentioned, onto a committee or a place where I've been able to vote. But a few years ago, we did try to require employers of a certain size to provide accommodations for a breastfeeding mother. As most of us agree, we aren't going to go into the restroom to eat our lunch. And we don't think that women should be expressing milk in there. We think there is a better place. I'm working at Ryman Gardens as my other job right now as a citizen legislator, and we do have a breastfeeding mom there, and we do have a room for her to go into, which makes me very proud. And when we have guests come to the gardens who are renting facilities, we allow them to use the same room. That's very important to me. I support increased family leave time for pregnancy, and on the other end of life, too. I have an elderly mother and elderly in-laws, and I am always thankful that there is emergency leave time to care for members of our family. We just can't ignore that. You know, if we are worrying about something that's going on outside of work, we are not the best employers. So it's really important for me to be able to take that time off and take my mother to the doctor sometimes. So I've also supported the adoption leave time. I think it's equally, maybe more important for an adoptive parent to have that time to bond, that extra time to bond. 5 of my 10 nieces and nephews, I think, are adopted, and certainly I believe that adoption is an important way to parent, and we need to give those individuals time. So in the whole spectrum, I think we need to, that employers need to give families more time, and they'll have better employees if they do.
I would support it because it's basically the kind human thing to do. You know, we're all humans. And if we all have children, we all experience the same thing. On the flip side, I don't think it should be abused either, you know. But yeah, I would support that.
Thank you.
I'm Mary Sand. I live in Ames. And in a previous forum, you've expressed your opposition to the Bakken pipeline. If you are elected, do you have a plan to stop it?
Well, I can tell you, I'm afraid the cat's out of the bag already, and I'm afraid the Pandora's out of the box. I don't know that we can stop that particular pipeline, but I do believe we can work on tightening up the eminent domain regulations to prevent it from happening again. I truly don't know how you would stop something, you know, because you're talking about the next legislative session doesn't start until January, and they'll have a whole lot of that pipeline done already. I think, regretfully, I don't think there's much you can do on that one, but you can work to try to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with Sandra at this point. You got to stay within the law when you're in the Iowa legislature, and I don't know that there's a legal way to actually stop it at this point through the legislature anyway. And I also agree with her that eminent domain is a terrible power and needs to be used only very sparingly in only those circumstances where it's genuine public good. And building a pipeline for a private company is an abuse of the eminent domain power. So I would like to see us tighten up our eminent domain laws and make sure that only when it's really a public good and there's no other way of getting around this, that's the only time one would use eminent domain to prevent something like this from happening again.
Sorry. This is one of those issues where we hashed this out in the legislature for a long time. There were several bills on eminent domain that never went anywhere, that the leadership was never even willing to bring up for discussion. I there was a lot of pressure, certainly, from large companies. And this is a place where I absolutely believe we need campaign finance reform. You know, in so many areas, we need campaign finance reform so that we can change the where the power sits. We tried increasing the requirements for the company to have more insurance. I think it's something like $250,000 is required now for the Bakken pipeline. That wouldn't clean up even the smallest of spills if a spill happens. So where does the money come from after that? You darn well know that they're going to be coming to the legislature. But some of the spill, I mean, some of the disasters that we've already seen are so tragic. And the amount of time and effort it's going to take to clean up after those is unreasonable. It's not that we haven't worked on it. It's not that we haven't made an attempt to do it. I signed on to a letter to the utilities board asking them to not approve it. That clearly fell on deaf ears. So I would like to tell you that there's hope, but I'm not seeing anything. If you have ideas, please share them with me.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Fredrickson, and I'm from Ames. My question relates to funding of education. Seems like the legislature has been very, very slow in releasing the budgets the schools will have year in and year out, and that really puts a lot of stress on administrators and teachers and everyone. What can be done to set more of a deadline when funding is given?
Okay. Well, I presume the internal rules of the legislature could be changed to try and get that done earlier in the session, maybe. I think, though, what we need to do is maybe change the funding scheme that we have now, where it's the funding's going to the districts, and rather make an announcement that we're going to attach a certain amount of money to the child. Because I would like to see the elimination of public schools in the state of Iowa. I think we should go to a system of privatization. There's what we've got in education is we've turned what should be a purely competitive market. There are very few barriers to entry to starting a school. And so there could be lots and lots and lots of schools in the state that can compete with one another because it's very easy for somebody to start a small school. And so what I'd like to do is shift from the monopoly education system we have now to a competitive market in education. Now, some people can't afford education, and that's the argument. Remember my four criteria for when you use the government. That's the argument for why we provide some funding for education, is because education is a public good. There are positive externalities associated with education. So even somebody like me who doesn't have kids that go to the schools, I do benefit from education funding because people are less likely to turn to crime if they're educated. People can count up change at the grocery store. Lots of benefits to me from having an educated populace. People make better decisions at the voting booth, presumably. So that's the argument for why we might use some tax funding to help people afford education. But there's absolutely no reason the government itself ought to be running the schools. That turns a purely competitive market, which is where the market works best, into a monopoly market where it works worst. What we should be doing is attaching the money to the individual child and then allowing private schools to operate, and the children can go wherever they want. And I think the amount of money that we give to the children is going to be a fixed amount, so I would think that it could be budgeted very quickly. So I'd like to see the state shift to that method rather than the method we're currently using.
Without government regulation at all?
That's correct.
Thank you. I'm a strong supporter of public education and have been very frustrated by the legislature's inability to follow the Iowa Code, which says that we have to approve an education budget, I believe, within 30 days after the governor releases his budget. So it's a little complicated, and that budget is 2 years in advance, I believe. So educators, school boards, administrators have time to to plan. I mean, how can you plan to improve a program, to increase a program, to do whatever, without some time? And these past years that we've been doing this, it's pink slips have to go out so that teachers know they may not be paid next year because the legislature has not done their job. So, you know, school districts are left with these teachers who are looking for other jobs, because if you get a pink slip, you have to assume that you're not going to have your job next year. There's so much insecurity in it. We just need to put some value on our children and make sure that the people who are going to be educating them have the ability to plan. And at this, over the past few years, we have not done that.
I spent a lot of this past year talking to a lot of different people, and I talked to the different superintendents in the school districts that are in this county. And I agree that the big issue is the legislature not deciding on the budget fast enough. I honestly would like to see us do that as the first order of business when the session starts. Just decide right there. Is it ever going to be easy? No. We have so much partisan bickering right now. And it's, that's just the fact. And you have to deal with it. A number of the superintendents gave me some really ideas that I thought were excellent about how to maybe restructure the collective bargaining for the teachers, because as it was explained to me, you know, Waukee is the biggest school district in the state right now and the fastest growing school district. And obviously, Waukee is going to have a lot different resources and a lot different needs than Colo or somebody like that, or United. And so right now, Waukee sets the precedent, and they decide, you know, how much raise and whatever else and different things. And maybe we need to rework that formula, because what Waukee can afford, Colo can't afford. I think there is a need for public schools. My children were both products of public schools, and they had fabulous educations. I do really also support school vouchers, however, though, because I think that if you want to send your kid to a private school, if you want to go to a Christian school, if you want to homeschool, you should have that right, and so you shouldn't have to pay double for that. You know, that's kind of a double taxation. Do I think that it's going to be tough for public schools in the very beginning? Maybe, but most people are going to choose to go to their neighborhood school just because it's easy, number one, and convenient. And number two, I think it will help make everything more competitive, because there are things that we're not as we've slipped on education. You know, from the time that we moved to Iowa, we've gone down a lot compared to what it used to be. We still have great schools and we still have great teachers, and the potential is very much there. We just need to help them realize that potential again. But yeah, getting the budget, getting their budget set, because I understand, how can you work with what if you don't know what it is? And there's a lot of teachers. I know the Ames superintendent told me, you know, he can live with these cuts and live with these budget prices, but he needs to know what they are, so he has time to work it on them and figure out what he has to do.
Is there pressure that can be placed within government someplace to get the budget set sooner?
By the citizens, put pressure on your lawmakers. Put pressure on the governor.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
That's all we have time for on Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio. You have been listening to a candidate forum held by the League of Women Voters among candidates for Iowa House District 45, Libertarian Eric Cooper, Republican Sandra Child-Smith, and Democrat Beth Wessel-Crichel. Next week, we will broadcast the League's Forum for Story County Supervisor candidates. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, and I edited the show. Evan Taylor engineered the show. This show will be aired again on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and can also be found on our webpage, khoifm.org. Thanks for listening to Politics is Local, and we'll see you again on the radio.